Hello and welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher on this edition of our show, another installment in the ongoing Museum Confidential podcast series, which is co-created by Public Radio Tulsa and Philbrook Museum of Art, and which is now in its seventh season. This time around, MC looks at Van Gogh in America, an important and much talked about show on view in Detroit that will close in just a few days. Again, thank you for tuning in to Museum Confidential here on Studio Tulsa.
Are you sitting comfortably? Then I shall begin.
Think about Detroit. The first thing that comes to mind might be cars, or maybe Motown. But for the past few months, the city of Detroit has been taken over by Vincent Van Gogh. In 1921, the Detroit Institute of Art was the first museum in the United States to purchase a painting by Van Gogh. Just over 100 years later, they're nearing the end of a blockbuster run for the exhibition aptly titled Van Gogh in America. The show features over 70 works and is the one and only venue. Nearly 60,000 people attended the show in the first 3 weeks alone. Curator Jill Shaw spent years moving mountains to pull this all together, facing challenge after challenge, only to reach the finish line and get delayed another year because of a global pandemic. But here we are. Van Gogh remains as popular as ever, maybe more than ever. But why? Jill joins us to talk about this monumental undertaking and much more. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we're catching you in the middle of a whirlwind of requests and all kinds of different things, but I want to just first say congratulations on the show. It's already been such a huge success. What's it feel like to kind of be in the middle of the eye of the hurricane, as it were?
I mean, I have the hurricane is a pretty correct way of describing the situation, but it's incredible. I mean, I think for any curator to have their exhibition be so successful, not only from a scholarly perspective, but also from a popular perspective, it's, you know, really all I could have asked for.
So the show Van Gogh in America opened in October, and last I saw you had well over 60,000 people who had already seen the show. I'm sure that number is obviously growing day to day. Has it already exceeded your expectations, or what did you, I know you knew it was going to be a big deal. I mean, there was buzz around the museum world for a while that this show was coming. It's the only venue for it. There's all kinds of different things that make it a destination, but has it exceeded your expectations already?
I mean, I think, the best way I can characterize it is in the words of my director, who said, "We're happy, but we always want to be happier."
There's no ceiling to happy, right?
Yeah. We're seeing an incredible response. I mean, we're thrilled with the number of people coming through the exhibition, but we, this is truly, and I'm a little bit biased, of course, I think this is a once in a lifetime show. And for me, it's a missed opportunity. If you're anywhere within the area, in the country, even in the world, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity to see these works together. And we just hope that everyone will come.
So the show runs through the end of January, or January 22nd, I believe, is the last day. Has there been any discussion about extending it? I guess you probably are tied into some pretty hard deadlines with all the loans and things like that. Are you going to stick with that end date?
Definitely. We definitely will. I mean, I'll say too, we have postponed this exhibition once. It was supposed to open in June of 2020. And so we were really lucky to get the loans for these new dates. And I'll say too, we have quite a few works on paper in the exhibition, which are light sensitive. They need to get back home. They need to get back home and in the dark. And also, from my perspective as a curator who oversees Van Gogh's in a permanent collection, people want to see them back. Our visitors to these museums want to see them come home. And so we will not be extending this exhibition as much as maybe I would love to, others would love to. We're not pursuing that.
You mentioned the delay on the show due to the pandemic, of course. What kind of opportunities did you find in that? You know, were you able to do more research? You know, I'm sure you used that time wisely. What benefit? There's certainly a lot of drawbacks, but what benefit did that extra time give you that we might not even see in the show, but you can see when you walk through the gallery?
I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think we all, you know, are down on the year 2020, but the postponement of this show really did provide me a really unique opportunity. I don't think I'll ever have as a curator again to go back into a checklist with all of the research done. When we were going to postpone the exhibition in March of 2020, the catalog was 3 days from going to print. And so I had this remarkable opportunity to go back into that catalog, look at all the research that we had compiled and revisit the checklist and potentially ask for new works that were relevant to the thesis now that maybe we didn't know at the outset. And so that was a really awesome opportunity for me. I'm glad that my director supported me in that endeavor. I think also too, I mean, we were able to celebrate with the new dates an anniversary year for the DIA. And we were able now to celebrate the centenary of this historic acquisition of Self-Portrait, which was the first painting by Van Gogh to be acquired by a U.S. museum.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Of course, you know, a lot of people may ask the question, why Detroit? And you guys have had such a great reason for that the whole time. But of course, this being this year, the reason becomes even more clear. So as you mentioned, you know, Detroit was the first museum in America to make this acquisition of a Van Gogh. It was not just any Van Gogh. It's a very recognizable Self-Portrait. When you've looked back into that period a century ago, was it a controversial acquisition? I'm sure you could find some documents that talk about this. Obviously, the money is a joke when you look at how much they spent on it compared to the numbers today. But beyond just that, talk about the rationale behind acquiring that piece and how strange it might have been for a museum to do so at that time when no one else was doing it.
In the contemporary press, we were noted as being courageous for having purchased this work in 1922. But honestly, you know, the DIA was looking to expand its collection. We had our eyes set on a new building that would open in 1927. We were looking to expand our collection in many ways. We needed to fill the walls of a new gallery, of a new museum. But we also wanted to ensure that Detroiters were seeing not only the old masters, but also contemporary art, modern and contemporary art. And so the acquisition of the Self-Portrait was part of this effort. But we were looking for Van Gogh a little bit earlier, even than 1922. And as part of our research, we learned that a drawing that's now in the collection of the Cleveland Museum of Art and is in our exhibition, we were looking to buy that in advance of our acquisition of the Self-Portrait. We were offered it. We went to the auction, bought Self-Portrait, came back and said we no longer have acquisition funds to pursue the watercolor that's now in Cleveland. And but for me, I mean, I think it's really remarkable that even in advance of 1922, people knew, dealers knew that the DIA was looking for a Van Gogh. And that was really unique for American museums of the day.
Prior to that 1922 acquisition, you know, 9 or so years earlier, the famous Armory show took place in New York, and that was the first coming out party for Van Gogh in America. Why do you think it took, because it made a splash then, of course, why do you think it took 9 years for that gap between, hey, Van Gogh's a major artist who was getting some notice in America? I mean, I know museums are very glacial in their decision-making, so that's nothing new to our listeners and people who know the world, but 9 years is a long time.
It sure is. And there were a few, you know, pioneering American private collectors who embraced Van Gogh much earlier than the museums did. So we have Albert Barnes to thank, we have John Quinn to thank, we have Catherine Dreyer to thank, as well as a few other individuals throughout the 19 teens. I think in the Armory show, I think there's a few reasons why Van Gogh's work didn't get the traction we might have expected. I think in the first place, organizers of the Armory show anticipated a much bigger and better showing and more comprehensive showing of Van Gogh's work. In the end, while only 18 were listed in the exhibition catalog, we know that 21, at least 21 were included. And we have 11 of those 21 on view in our exhibition. And what you can see immediately is that it's a very eclectic grouping of works. I think visitors to the exhibition might not have had the best sense of what Van Gogh was about, But I'll also say that of the at least 21 works on view in the Armory show, only two were not for sale. So meaning the rest were for sale and none of them sold. And I think in part it was because the prices were really high for an artist that we didn't quite get a sense of their oeuvre as a complete whole, for an artist that we hadn't really heard of except for in newspaper articles and black and white publications. But, you know, at the turn of the century, Van Gogh's works were already popular in Europe. The prices were already, you know, pretty escalated, especially for the American market, where we could not really see a great representation of his work at the Armory show. Works were going for the same prices as Monet paintings were going for. Americans had already bitten the Monet bug. We were on board. And it was difficult, I think, for a lot of people to accept that a Van Gogh painting, you know, some critics said, you know, he was a moderately incompetent impressionist, that he was wasting artistic materials and supplies. And it was hard for us to pay those elevated prices for an unknown.
Wasting materials because he's chunking it onto the canvas so strongly and those kind of huge puddles of oil paint. Yeah. So 22 happens, you acquire this piece, but it's really not till quite a while later into the century when, you know, maybe in the 30s when Lust for Life, the book comes out. Is it in the 30s when the book comes out? Yes. And so this is a novel, you know, historical fiction about the life of Van Gogh, which is then made into a film with
Kirk Douglas.
There you go. But when the book comes out, it does kind of line up with New York museums taking note. I believe the first MoMA exhibition happens either the same year or right around the same time as that novel coming out. And so that's when things really boom, they blow up. So that's kind of the idea of Van Gogh, where the story of the person starts becoming intertwined with the work itself. It's a big question, but in 2022, does Van Gogh endure mostly because of the work, his story, or a combination of the two?
I think it's definitely a combination of the two. And I think Van Gogh scholars for the past decades have been trying to poke holes into some of the myths that are really prevalent in our minds and that have really been concretized by Hollywood and, you know, recent biopics and immersive experiences. People are still compelled by his biography. I think it's our responsibility now to nuance that biography and maybe tell it in ways that are more sensitive to Vincent. But it is, there is something just palpably attractive about his paintings. People respond to the colors, but I think even more so, people respond to the subject matter. Everything he does is celebrating the everyday. It's celebrating the every man, the every woman, the every person. And so we see him, you know, raising the perception of agricultural laborers to heroes. We see him raising the profile of everyday city gardens into heroic landscapes. We see him using his own boots, for example, as part of his experimentation in color and in technique. And I mean, there's something really compelling about the kinds of subjects that he chooses to treat.
I was in prep for this. I was reading some of the letters between Vincent and his brother Theo, which have been published widely and are a fascinating read. What was interesting to me is how contemporary they feel and their concerns. And I was thinking, if you were a young person who loves Euphoria and you read the letters between Van Gogh and Theo, there would be some similar concerns, you know, and I think some of those things are why he endures so much. But I'm curious, what's been the response of young people to this exhibition so far?
Well, I mean, I think people, it's a hard question. I mean, I think over the past 2 years, not only our youth, but also adults have really thought once again about their lives, about their existence, about the meaning of what they're doing and revisiting all of that. And I think, you know, Vincent, so late in life, really committed himself to becoming an artist. He only worked for 10 years. And I think there's something really captivating about that for us, that you can, late in your career, change directions. And I think, you know, for young people today, who many of whom are experiencing an increased percentage of mental crisis and health emergencies. I think there's something soothing in Vincent's story. He is able to dig deep to pursue the path that he feels is best for him. Unfortunately, you know, it ended in a tragic way, and he died by suicide. However, I think there's a little bit of light in his story, in that he finally finds his path, even though it ends tragically, in a roundabout way.
It's very complicated.
It is.
But the complication is why it's fascinating. Detroit, of course, has famously had, you know, a lot of ups and downs, you know, economically, all kinds of things. There was a ton of flight and, you know, a lot of return, especially after the most recent Great Recession and all kinds of things. So I'm just curious what it's been like for you to be part of something that is really just bringing people back to the city. I'm guessing there are tons of people traveling from outside of Detroit to see this show, people who may have never been to Detroit before or haven't been there in a long time. So, you know, beyond just the show itself and the work itself and Vincent Van Gogh, things like this have impacts beyond, you know, that. There's a municipal impact, all kinds of things. What's it been like for the city just to have this show, to have something joyful to celebrate, bring people in, show off the assets of the city?
It's a good question. I like to actually think of it in a different way. I know in our community, you know, people will say Detroit never went anywhere. We have always been here. And we do have different ways to tell the story and different ways to shine, but Detroit never left. And I am especially heartened by those visitors who think that, you know, an exhibition about Vincent Van Gogh, it's just business as usual. It's another a dead white male who we're celebrating posthumously. And I've been incredibly encouraged by members of our community who have changed their mind about Van Gogh and have changed their mind about even wanting to come see the exhibition. I'd say that that is probably the most important feedback that I've received. I mean, of course, as a museum with a collection like ours, we want to attract international audiences, but we have an incredible responsibility to our local communities, and the response that we've received from them is incredible.
So, you know, I'm sure that internally your teams have goals for attendance for the show. There's goals for, you know, monetary concerns, all these different things. But for you personally, after January 22nd, the thing's wrapped up, you're done with the show. What's your metric for success? How do you know if this did what you wanted it to do?
I think I'm really excited for people to, you know, maybe have in the forefront of their minds that this is a uniquely Detroit story. But not only that, it's also a uniquely Midwestern story. So after the DIA purchased Self-Portrait in 1922, the next museums to acquire works by Van Gogh were all Midwestern. It wouldn't be till 1941 that the Museum of Modern Art purchased The Starry Night by Van Gogh. And I would love to see the celebration of what, you know, is often seen as an overlooked region in the United States for the collecting of avant-garde art. And I think for me, it's particularly resonant. I went to college in the Midwest. I went to graduate school in the Midwest. I've seen and studied the remarkable collections that have been amassed here. And I really think that I hope that people take away that the Midwest is not to be overlooked.
Yeah, you know, as someone who's a fellow person in the big middle, I think, you know, there's a lot of space here, you know, and you're talking about places like the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City and perhaps the Art Institute of Chicago and all these places. I mean, there's a lot of amazing museums between the coasts. And I think there's no doubt that if people haven't been to these places, they should put them on their list for sure.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by palette knives. Paintbrushes seem to get all the attention, all the glory, and we get it. They are graceful, maybe even beautiful, that fine hair. And they come in all shapes and sizes. There's nothing particularly cool or exceptional to point out about palette knives, although Bob Ross certainly tried to change that. But palette knives do get the job done. It's just that simple. They perform. Try mixing paint or getting that tree trunk just right without these flexible steel blades at hand. As a painter, of course you rely on these creative little workhorses, these palette knives. And if you'd like to hear more about them, we do recommend a new daily podcast, Palette People. New season out now, wherever you find your podcasts.
Most museums who have Van Gogh pieces, those are the stars of their collection and people will come there to see them. So they're very stingy when it comes to sharing those pieces. Mm-hmm. Were you able to get what you wanted? Did you have a wish list that ended up being kind of somewhat frustrating, or at the end of the day, did you get what you really wanted to have for this show?
I'll quote my director again. We're happy, but we always could have been happier. You know, I had an initial checklist of probably over 100 objects. And
there's what, 74.
I mean, we set out on this project. When I look back at our very first loan letters, we were hopeful for 40. And so we really did a tremendous job of advocating for our exhibition, for advocating, you know, the fact that Detroit needed to tell the story and that this is a new scholarly opportunity for people to contribute to. But of course, there are works that were promised even for the 2020 installation that we weren't able to secure for the 2022 installation. And there were others that weren't available for 2020 that now we were able to acquire for 2022. You know, an exhibition of this scale and scope, I could have had easily 200 works, but I also, you know, I'm a curator. I respect that museums need to be attentive to their visitors. It's difficult to let some of these works out, as you mentioned, but also so many of his works now can't travel because of their fragility. And, you know, I'm a curator. I'm not going to, you know, sort of poo-poo that idea that something can't travel because of its condition.
You mentioned this before. There is this kind of trend going on with these immersive experiences, and every city seems to be inundated with these big warehouse mall type target size buildings with projected art experiences. Probably the most popular, or at least well-known, is the Van Gogh immersive experience. And I think there's various versions of that actually traveling around. One part of me sees that as a possible gateway. You know, if people have no relationship to this artist and they go to that and they love it, well, they're probably going to come see your show too, right? I don't see them as mutually exclusive. On the other hand, some people think they're the end of art as we know it and see it as a total apocalypse. Where do you kind of land on that whole topic?
I side with you on this. I think it's a completely different experience, but I do appreciate the exposure that artists can get, you know, from these immersive experiences. And, you know, to be perfectly, you know, clinical about it, it provided our exhibition with incredible pre-publicity, to be honest.
People primed, ready to go.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I think it's just a totally different experience. And, I'd like to think of a day where, you know, a Detroiter goes to the immersive experience in the morning and then comes to our exhibition in the afternoon. And you really get that incredible juxtaposition of images that are quite intimate and small and that have incredible texture, and they're sculptures in and of themselves. So in the morning, they've seen it projected huge on the wall with little definition. And then in the afternoon to see what intimate works they are in the craftsmanship that's involved in them. I mean, I think that would be a cool day.
Yeah, you know, I kind of think of it like, you know, if you got to see a Thomas Moran painting of the Grand Canyon, it's not like you're going to turn down your chance to go see the real Grand Canyon too. They're going to be different experiences.
I would like to say though, that, you know, I think, you know, we're providing for our audiences the real deal at a more inexpensive price.
Well, there is that for sure. Those things are not, your cost benefit ratio is quite better at a museum, I would say. You know, I think we're safe to say that. So your director comes into you, you know, getting close to the end of the show, and they say, Jill, we've decided, we talked to the other museums, we're going to let you take home one of these pieces. One of these Van Goghs is going to be yours now. You get to keep it as a thank you for this, all this great work out of the 74 pieces. And you have to decide which one it's going to be, or even, you know, because you can make the argument, well, I don't want to hide it away in my house. They say, you get to keep one for the museum. Which one is it going to be for you?
Well, I was going to ask that question. Is it for my house or is it for the museum? Because I would take different.
You know what? Let's give you two. I'm going to give you two. Yeah. Let's say you get one for the museum and one for your house. Where are we going with this?
So if it were one for the museum, I would definitely want to complement our current holdings. We have a portrait. We have a marine scape. We have a still life. We have a portrait of Postman Roulin. We have a portrait of the Diggers from his period living in the psychiatric clinic in Saint-Remy. So I would want something to really complement that. And I do think a beautiful Paris period work would be incredibly helpful for us. I will say personally, I mean, you always joke. I mean, it's not never going to happen in reality. If there's a fire, which one are you going to run in and take with you?
Yeah. Different question, but similar concern. Yeah.
And for me, it's a work that's actually in a private collection in the exhibition. It's a beautiful impressionist painting of Basket with Oranges. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think it truly shows sort of this pivotal moment in his career where he's absorbing lessons from the Impressionists and the Neo-Impressionists, but he's starting to infuse his own might and his own will and his own path in it. I just think it's an exquisite picture. And if I could have this, it would be amazing. However, somebody else has that and it dons the walls of their home. So I guess I answered both at once. I do love this picture. There's another picture that I think would be an awesome complement to our collection, and that's the one from the Phillips collection. It's a painting that Van Gogh made in Arles of the garden that was just outside of his yellow house. I think it would be amazing to have a landscape from Arles to kind of complement our Postman Roulin. And, you know, it's a very pivotal time when Van Gogh was in Arles working with Paul Gauguin. And I think that our collection could certainly benefit from a landscape from that time period.
For they could not love you, but still your love was true.
Singer-songwriter Don McLean is known primarily for his anthemic story song, American Pie, from his album of the same name. It was recorded in 1971 and released that fall. The song entered the Billboard charts at number 69 and crept up to number 1 by early 1972, spending a month in the top spot. But McLean is no one-hit wonder. Released in February 1972, the second single off the album was Vincent, a melancholy and art reference-laden tribute to the life of Vincent van Gogh. The tune is often referred to as Starry, Starry Night, but that's just the opening refrain. Vincent hit number 1 on the UK singles chart and peaked at number 12 in the US. Just like Van Gogh's paintings, Don McLean's music endures and appeals to a wide spectrum of listeners. Vincent was a favorite of Tupac Shakur. The song was played for him in the Las Vegas hospital room where Tupac was admitted just before he died of gunshot wounds from a drive-by shooting.
Now I think I know what you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they're not listening still. Perhaps they never will.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Until next time, look closer.